Okay, guys, welcome to our little Design Indaba roundup. This is day one, Wednesday. We've been through most of the day here. The day is about to end, and I'm sitting downstairs outside the Simplecast Auditorium with Lucas and Zay Josephs, a good friend of ours and professional photographer. Welcome to the show, Zay.
Yeah. Hi, guys.
This is Zay's first Design Indaba as well.
It is my first Design Indaba after hearing about it for all these years. There's a few times that I actually wanted to go, and yeah, I kind of got roped into this one happily.
So you're our Design Indaba virgin here. Lucas has been, yep. How many times would you say?
Many.
You popped your cherry a long time ago.
Coming since my first year of studying.
And you've been coming fairly consistently as well. I think it's been about 3 or 4, the first time since it moved to Artscape, I hadn't been. Mm-hmm. So this is my first time at Artscape. But you've been coming since, until what, about a year ago? You were here last year?
Yes, I was here last year. I've been coming since 2004.
Wow, okay, 2004. Yeah. So that's good. We've got a pretty good range of experience with Design Indaba. Yeah. Let's start with Zaid. What are your thoughts as the newbie, your first experience with Design Indaba? Everything from the expo outside, you know, the food trucks, the show itself, the conference speakers. What are your impressions?
I think you touched on the aspect for me that kind of separates it from what I'm used to. Let me explain. What I'm used to is getting this type of information online.
Sure.
So these kind of talks that we have on the stage from all the speakers, there's a plethora of this kind of information that you find online, stuff sure. that's been recorded, people doing talks. And my view on the Design Indaba was always that me thinking about it in terms of the information I can always get. So what, in a crude way, what was the point of me actually coming here? But my takeaway from the whole thing is the social. There's some social aspect of being around like-minded people, and you have there's a different way of like absorbing the information.
And you get to talk about it with people.
Exactly. Yeah.
And definitely catching up with people outside during the breaks.
Yeah.
The breaks have actually been probably one of the most interesting parts of today as well, just because you see faces you haven't seen in ages.
Exactly. Yeah.
Conversations on my side have ended up being, you know, reconnecting with people who I might now work with in the near future.
Totally. Look, I can watch something similar to this on YouTube at home.
Sure.
I had no idea that it's indirectly quite a networking kind of experience. You come here and to see something, but it's like-minded people.
Sure.
So people just broadly in the creative industry, you reconnect with, and you start talking about ideas, and that actually, weirdly enough, that's actually sparking me to think. That's sparking me more to think. So maybe that part of it is helping me actually open up a bit more to actually what's being, you know, so it's making me absorb more.
Sure. If I can add to that, the idea that there are TED Talks online, there are, you're completely right, all this resource is there, but the angle is different. I find the African angle is way
stronger. You're totally right.
This
totally
is
right.
We don't get exposed to. TED Talks and all that
exactly.
stuff doesn't cover that aspect of it.
Fully
so
agree.
There's a big cultural thing, not just a design thing. Although design is part of it, but as an example, when we went the Shoma Josie, you won't see that. That's entertainment.
Yeah.
Pop culture, not
Absolutely.
Necessarily design as a as a philosophy. So when with her stuff, and you, it was awesome that you already knew about her stuff anyways, and this was an introduction for me. I've been a little bit out of it for a year, but the idea about Tonga culture.
Can I cut in with a quick bit of context here for anyone listening? Shoma Josie is obviously a very up and coming big hip hop star in South Africa, and her presentation was talking about the Songa tradition of the name of the style of dress.
Shibalani.
Right. So, and she was talking about it historically and how she's adapted it into her own work, the meaning behind the design, the historical, cultural aspects of it. And so she brought culture into her more performance-based presentation.
Yeah.
So as you say, it's not just pure design.
Yeah. And also just the Moshe Bilani, it's this, it's like a skirt of sorts that accentuates women's shape. And it was, to me, it was an education. It was entertainment. Her songs were amazing. The production of it is great. So there's
sense of humor she brought as well.
So it was completely. There was a little bit of a throwback, and I could see a little bit of the Antwoord putting a little bit of paving the way for that.
Mm, yeah.
Just global culture when it when
Fatty Boom Boom had a certain couple of elements. Completely.
Yeah.
I think they made black bag versions of that.
Yeah. So it was nice to see a different version of that, but also kind of that there's a gate, there are people paving that way, or the gateway has opened up very nicely for African culture and African signature coming through.
Hmm. Yeah, my big takeaway from her presentation was how she didn't compromise herself or an image competing internationally. It's quite a confident thing to be like, you know what, I'm in my language and my style of music and my fashion, I'm tweaking it a little bit because I've got influences internationally, but I don't have to change my look completely. And she kind of succeeded becoming an international star.
Absolutely. I mean, I think taking a cultural aspect that you're proud of and leaning on it and accentuating it and making it your own certainly hasn't done her wrong. When John Cena surprises you on a talk show in America, you're doing something right. Not too many South Africans are cracking that market.
Yeah,
the Antwoord paved.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that globally there's an appetite for it now. On her vibe when taking cultural aspects, and what's there's a big thing about in the idea of cultural appropriation. In this case, it was cultural evolution. She's got the approval from the traditionalists, and then from the cutting edge styling point of view. And there's such a nice balance that got struck there, and also in her videos with traditional leaders, community leaders, got talking about what she's doing and approving of it.
Quite surprised. I was waiting for the moment where, you know, that older gentleman on the video where he's going to say, "Oh, it's very scandalous," you know, and he actually went entirely in the opposite direction, saying, "You know, there's no African prejudice against nudity or shortening the skirt, for example." I mean, they're obviously it can't be done from without. It has to be done from within. But they are incredibly supportive of it.
That was even if it's and she's making a documentary. And what is also awesome about, again, now the networking, to build on your networking comment, is that she goes, "I'm making a documentary about this. If there's anybody who can help me do this," and I was like, "Well done. That's awesome. Play that card." People will stand in a queue to try and tell that story. It's a compelling story.
Did you get the build up of her being in a way, like you said, approved, where she built it up by saying this is how traditionally it's supposed to look, but because of the ages of different people coming into the country and different styles and fabrics
and materials,
the fabrics and materials, how it's evolved and changed. So it's kind of, she kind of drew like a graph that kind of went up to where she is, as opposed to it being one look and one style for 200 years, and then boom, she just rocks up here with something different. So that kind of evolution kind of set it, and she was, the traditional people understand it.
Yeah.
So the first one she showed us from like the black and white photos, and then when she changed to the wool, she spoke about the wool and all the colors and the fabrics and how it became more affordable, and then it leaned, and then she said this is what she grew up with, this was part of what she identifies as beauty at that stage, so that's why she connected to that style versus the older style. And when people kind of in the tribe and the tradition accepted the wool look as this is still part of it, this shows that they accept her look, which is slightly different. They looked at it and said, you know what, that is part of what we do.
Yeah. And I think a key takeout that from the end of that presentation was that that culture shouldn't be put into a museum setting. it shouldn't be. She was talking that style shouldn't live in a museum. It should be alive. It should be.
That's how you keep culture alive. That was a very, very cool point.
Yeah.
If you want something to, don't put it in. That's the first. Like kids are just going, oh, that's old.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I like to signify, oh, that's done now.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
I'm literally putting it next to dinosaurs and saying, hey, respect.
This is dead.
It's not. Absolutely. Yeah.
No, I think that's a very, very cool way of thinking.
Yeah.
I gotta say, my mind was blown by Hanif Kara as well.
Right. Same. Okay. So
also, pieces of my mind on the floor.
Initial, and this is now the
a little bit of context again. Yeah, that's right. I'm basically just going to read the bio from the app here. This maverick structural engineer designs a better world. As an educator, Kara is challenging the next generation of structural engineers to think outside the box. No small accomplishment in a design discipline better known for linearity. So he's a structural engineer who has worked on some of the structures that we've seen at Design Darba, stuff designed by Thomas
iconic.
Heatherwick and huge iconic buildings that I think your point on this is the guy who gets it done.
Yeah, he basically, the architect has a dream and he goes, money, capabilities, technology, let's go and find a way to do this. And there was a sense of, I can't talk about, when he would talk about some of the projects, you'd go like, oh my God, because the bar is so high and the stuff he can't talk about is more intriguing than the stuff that he has spoken about.
Right.
So every one of those things that they showed, we'd never seen before. Like you'd never seen it in a sci-fi book. You'd never thought about it. Trailblazing, I suppose.
Yeah, groundbreaking stuff, both mechanically, engineering-wise, very much a scientist. And a lot of the stuff that we were seeing on screens while he was talking about, for example, I think the hottest thing in architecture right now is Thomas Heatherwick's, what is the name of the structure?
Zayed's Mokka.
No, that infinite stairway building that everyone talks about.
Dude, you got me on that one. Yeah. I can't remember. I can't remember the name of the thing.
Yeah, the name exactly.
Okay, well, I'm sure there's so much to take in. Lots of people will be screaming the exact name of it, but we'll
edit it in. Edit it in.
We'll do an edit.
If I can quickly just chuck in something. There was a nice key takeout for me on, because he's the engineer. So the architect comes in with the dog and pony show going like, ta-da, my vision, I'm a fucking maverick and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. He comes in and closes the deal in the presentation. So when
they the costs right.
Yeah, well, costs and it's possible.
And possibility, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so it's all good and well. We have this floating staircase that cones out from the center and we have no idea how it stays up. He does.
Sure.
And when if you think about these guys are doing these projects that need to go through planning permissions, the government needs to look at it and be convinced that it can be done. So, and I equate it to directors with producers. The director goes, I have this vision. And then the producer comes, here's the budget, here's the schedule, here's everything, how we're going to make this happen. And it was just, it's nice seeing that side of things.
Yeah, I think it really exemplifies a theme of this year's Design and DARPA, which is think tank, do tank.
Yes.
And it's great to hear from a real doer within a discipline that Design DARPA sees a lot of architects, and as you say, we hear a lot of dreams, and we see a lot of amazing things without a real insight into not just the construction and the engineering, but as he talked about the building standards authorities that he has to deal with in America and England and in Azerbaijan, that must be a Herculean task.
Yeah.
Besides being like Professor X with having things done, I think one of his superpowers is patience.
Yeah, absolutely.
It must be. It must
2 years for that software.
The level of bureaucracy.
2 years to develop a software to make sure you can build a structure. I mean, you still have to go and build a
tower. Oh, it's about seismic forces that would act on an asymmetrical building. So
totally.
He showed a lot of 3D renders, a lot of imagery that showed how force is applied through a building, how from top to bottom where the weight lands, and showing the stresses on the building. And that's obviously something they modeled.
Coming after the design.
Yeah.
So they had the design, then they were like, oh, wait.
Let's figure this out now.
Yeah, and the reasons why I say patience is because if someone had to show me a design for a building, and I've been in love with architecture from way back, the thought of me waiting 2 years to see the construction, I can't, the man is patient.
But I think that is it's long-term projects and long-term thinking, and that's that
That's rare now.
Yeah.
To think beyond your own generation.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the projects we do, does it take that long?
No, never. Never. That's also something that struck me, was like their stuff lasts for a long time. Our stuff is thrown away. From a graphic design point of view, mm-hmm. from an advertising point of view, ours is short shelf life. We're the junk food of stuff. And this was nice to see whole meals, you know, like hearty. It was really, really cool. If I can also chuck in something, and it was I just when we were talking about it in the auditorium, I read the piss brick. It was such the piss brick.
And that was presented by Bukari.
Bukari, he was taking the piss.
Yeah,
he was taking the piss.
Master's candidate in civil engineering at UCT. He is using bacteria to turn essentially urine into
Urine. Urine with so the urine sand. Works with the sand. And the bacteria uses the urine as like fuel to rework the sand into
a binding agent, that can
complete binding clay in terms of strength.
It was just from a sexy title point of view. You go like, yeah, no, they jumped out. The piss brick.
Sure.
You know, like, and just again,
it becomes the day's joke, and
yes, exactly.
No one forgets it. It sticks.
And then right after that, it goes. People, everybody thought the same thing, the poo brick.
Yeah.
You know, like yes, and then it's shit the brick and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But what was awesome about his talk was the humbleness of it. He spoke about the team and his predecessors, the people who actually who he studied with or doing the research projects with. So there was a nod to everybody in that who's involved. The problem with the podcast format for this talk is that it is visual.
I will be trying, when I upload this on our Instagram channel, I'll be putting a couple of images, hopefully I can pick up from their website and just give people an idea. So pop over to our Instagram, which is at the resource cast, and hopefully you'll be able to get some idea of what we're talking about.
Just to quickly also just add on it, I love the repurposing of technology. I remember reading that ammonia gets used in the dyeing industry.
Yep.
And in London, old London, they used to also gather piss.
Yeah.
They used to go and get
real tweed. It smells like urine.
Yes. And that's why they apparently asked about the House of Parliament, what does it smell like? And they go, it smells of pee. Because of the suits that they would wear and the upholstery that was on everything. But there was also within, so it's the piss brick, but how do you get the piss? So I love this, the collection.
The waterless
but
urine.
The sewage. And the sewage treatment, or less energy that you use.
There were so many benefits to it at face value. Like, it's also, like, I don't know, it does feel like if we are, if humans are creating something, yes, we should be using it as well. And it's almost like it got me thinking about the body separates it. Otherwise, we would have been... There is something useful in urine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There seems to be something.
Yeah. And it's amazing how when you get out into space, suddenly everything's recyclable.
Yes.
Recyclable.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, nothing is wasted.
You can get water out of it.
Turned into something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My what I liked about his talk was the thinking around the biomimicking, but also how this concept of building something compared to concrete. About how much waste concrete produces, how much energy is actually needed to create concrete, and it's this does it in a low energy consumption, low water consumption way, other than the water we drink for the actual piss. But it's it reminds me of interesting read up I had on silk from spiderweb silk,
right.
How it's stronger than steel, and it doesn't rust, it doesn't have all these problems, but it's able to do it, like spiders are able to do it with very little energy, just the energy that they use, but at room temperature with no waste. Mm. And so this is connected to that. Mm. And it there's an connected to another interesting read up about how these enzymes that they found in the polar caps, that with cold water you can clean laundry. You don't actually have to heat up the water. So just this low energy and using bio stuff that's available. I dig it. That drew me in quite a bit.
Sure.
So we're hearing quite a lot of bass up. coming from outside. There's a
you'll tune us out.
Like the music show is about to start now.
Just we'll noise
gate it out if we can.
Was there anything else that jumped out at you guys?
For me, I found Bass Timber's presentation on the shelter suit was certainly something that got a lot of popular acclaim from the crowd. The crowd loved it. He got a standing ovation. Bass is from
Amsterdam,
the Netherlands.
Yeah,
and he's a fashion designer who, let's see here, been working on a winter clothing range when he heard that a friend of his father, who had been rendered homeless, had died of hypothermia while waiting for a shelter to open. Distressed, Timmer vowed to come up with a solution to protect the homeless from extreme cold, and the shelter suit was born. Basically, using upcycled and recycled materials, he created a warm winter jacket with an attachable sleeping bag, and gave it away for free, and then just kept developing it. And at the end of, by the time we got to the end of his presentation, Design & Dab had funded, I believe, 150 or
250.
A slightly less cold weather version of his shelter suit for the South African homeless population. And Woolworth stepped up and pledged to fund 250 more suits, and they have now challenged other corporates to match that.
So that's the positive side thing that came out of this. I think it's a fantastic initiative. I think from a point of view, and I'm going to reveal my cynical approach to it a little bit,
because
I think we do get swept up in the do good aspect of things. There was an ask you could donate, but it's $600.
$600 per
thing, and in the world of where we're playing in, the efficiencies need to come down. You need to be
it
way
needs
more,
to be cheaper.
It needs to be cheaper. It can't be just this project of Bastima, and the scale is so small.
Yeah.
And in this, so essentially, it's a sleeping bag, but that's wearable, which isn't a new thing. The great thing about what he did was this is an initiative that someone's at least doing and getting support behind it. Where I think, if we look at it with a critical eye, you go like, okay, then you need to look at the materials. We need to make this more accessible to everybody else. Is that solving the homeless problem? The trick with helping people, I think, scalability. Even if you help one, if you save one life, it's great. But I think once you're in manufacturing, it goes from being a charitable thing to being making a real difference.
I think that what's interesting about his idea is it actually works on a scaled level, in that it's using manufacturing cutoffs and wastage to be able to create these suits. And it is a much more scalable concept than many other charities and NGOs that work on a kind of a grassroots level, and they're affecting relatively small populations. I guess the trick is that most of the, for example, the textile manufacturing industry was based in Cape Town, was more or less been hollowed out by the Chinese market, the cheaper manufacturing to be found there. So our access to that kind of scale of wastage and spare material that can be repurposed, I'm not sure it ends up with a suit that costs $600, which I think you pointed out, you can find a sleeping bag online for $300-$400, and then a jacket. Is it really... is it really justifying its cost?
That's my issue with it a little bit. Not that, again, I'm coming across as a cynical bastard where someone's trying to help homeless people. And I'm like, yes, the cold suits help X amount of people who are stuck in that situation in Europe. So sometimes there's the first world solution to a third world problem doesn't always connect completely. So we just have to keep that in mind. So as an example, in South Africa, sometimes, especially if you're tackling homelessness, and again, Bass is making an impact, and it's great for an auditorium full of us sitting there going, oh, that's such a rad thing. But in a real
practical
world situation, you have to, it has to be approached slightly differently. Like, and I wish I had the solution. Yeah, I can't tell what it is, but it feels to me everybody should have this. And I like, when I was looking at it, I was like, there should be a future where we don't need houses, we just zip up the suit and go lie down on the ground, you know what I mean? Like, that you become, that the technology catches up so that everybody can use it. So to me, that's maybe a scalable thing. Maybe it's pie in the sky thinking. I apologize if I'm being cynical.
I think I see what it could be, and I think he has two good deeds that is kind of solving, right? The one is the homeless, and the other one, which is the I think is the reason why it's 600 rand, is the Syrian refugees and their payment, which I think from the Netherlands that
you
kind of
go
payment
into
is
that
extended.
Explaining what you mean by the Syrian refugees.
So okay, so what he did was he was looking for someone to manufacture, and then he found out that in the area there's all these Syrian refugees that were living in the Netherlands, and he went to them and found out that these guys, mostly guys, were actually skilled people that could work in factory and sewing machines really, really well. So he asked them to come in, and he was blown away by the way they worked, the speed and the quality of what they did. He even went over to the island. There's an island nearby,
Lesbos, where a lot of refugees are in a holding pattern, essentially.
Exactly. And then he helped them out as well. But the reason why I talk about the 600 rand, I think a lot of it has to do with maybe... See, our viewpoint on cost to produce something is based on what comes out of China or India or any one of those countries where the labor is extremely cheap. I don't think he is thinking in labor terms of salaries compared to their wages, right?
Sure.
He's thinking on Netherlands wages. And I think that is probably the reason why it's 600 rand. Because if he didn't, right, which is what Lucas is saying, if the focus was more on actually just getting the most suits done for the lowest amount of money so we can get the most suits out, he would go to China and they would make it for 100 rand a suit.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe the issue. That's my view on it.
The model could include employing the homeless themselves, upskilling them,
yes,
with the manufacturing, if we had the manufacturing, the tools, the spaces,
yeah,
the... And of course, the complex,
I like
the complex
the
work of taking someone.
Homeless. I like the
exactly.
homeless not to be homeless.
Yeah. But it's not easy to take someone, upskill them when they might come with a tick addiction or other kind of dependency issues. But anyway, it's a complex thing.
That is a complex thing.
Well, they're a fine art student.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or a fine art student who definitely has some kind of addiction.
What do they do? Yeah, someone's going to help them out.
If I can quickly jump in, who was the lady who did who wanted to relook rape kits? I can't remember.
That was Anya Weigemanis.
Okay. That's the cool thing about Design Indaba is that a lot of people come from all different places.
Yeah, you can't pronounce the names. That is an incredibly long name. Weigemanis.
I loved it. I thought she, because it's something that's completely out of a male reference.
Yeah.
And to go like, what is the steps a person has to go through when they've gone through one of the most horrific things a human being can go through, and try and make that process a little bit easier is awesome. And that project doesn't have a scale problem. I hope to God that it doesn't have a scale problem. Whereas like something like that can, her looking at the user experience for a traumatic event, I think it's commendable. Think it's also something that people just sometimes shy away from, and it was nice. It was very, very nice.
And the real difference it can make in terms of convictions, in terms of getting DNA evidence, because that seems to be, there's just not enough training, there's not enough resources, and I think it's an incredible little initiative that had everyone kind of, everyone was quiet, everyone saw the need for it, they saw the genius behind it.
Yeah, I like the fact that it kind of opened... It opened up a lot of people's eyes, especially myself, because I haven't been close enough to somebody who has had that kind of experience that needed a kit for me to know exactly what a person actually goes through with that kit and what it actually entails.
Yeah, there's a lot of capacity.
My ignorance around it, like that was quite hectic. So I'm glad that I got to see it, and
I'm also glad the topic came up. It's a good thing to talk about, and at a design festival again, and that credit to Design Indaba as a place where these things do get mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, I'll just mention some other people who have some of the other speakers we had.
Patrick
Thomas, who visited
collaborative
all of the different
design.
Vega collaborative design.
Yeah.
Visited pretty much every Vega School of Communication,
and they did Red and Yellow.
So they got a red and yellow as
yeah.
well. Right. We had a chat from Catherine Larson, who was talking about a greener building industry.
He spoke with the Seawood, the Seagrass.
Seagrass.
Has the insulation, has the roofing. Yeah, it was great, sustainable.
Yeah.
What's awesome is these are theses. These are students that are coming out with
these global grads are all working on theses.
It's fantastic. So the idea is to grow, use seaweed to thatch, and it's not a new thing. It's actually a traditional
and insulation,
thing.
Yeah.
And it's to use it as insulation in buildings. It has a natural breathability to it. So all the science is there, and again, it's a function of the traditional way of doing things. If you hark back all the way to Josie's stuff, it's a traditional thing that
and then which they almost lost the knowledge of how to do because modern materials took their place, and they had to kind of unearth and protect that.
Well, it's cool about what she was doing with the fact that she went back to tradition. So tradition just. It communicates that it's something from a long time ago, before synthetic things were made, before poly anything was kind of made. So everything back then was biodegradable.
Sure.
Everything was made of the earth. So she kind of went back to that. So when if you make a house that is kind of well insulated with seagrass and it's the roof, if everything and it's wood, the wooden frame, you can pull everything out of the house and leave it, and nature will just take it back, and it doesn't pollute, doesn't mess with the water. It's great.
Yeah.
There's one thing that Cape Town's got, it's kelp around. So maybe there's an opportunity for us as well.
Yeah, well, kelp does get used. It's as a supplement. So,
sure.
Yes.
Oh, very importantly, what was a big driving force for her was the fact that she discovered that the people responsible for actually building these ancient structures were the women.
Yes, that was an interesting...
Because the seagrass was the way they turn it into thatch is a weaving process.
Yeah.
So it was interesting again, well, interesting here to see women in construction traditionally.
They had to kind of figure it out. So that was quite an inspirational thing for her, being a woman.
Sure.
And pushing it.
Yeah, I think mainly here we're highlighting the speakers who we found to be interesting and worthy of a quick conversation. So I think last, let's talk about Alexandra Genis, I imagine, who is an artist and principal designer at TAS2R, a studio propagating gastrointestinal design fiction. She uses She uses food as a biochemical and visual tool to transmit challenging ideas about ecology, innovation, and science. And to translate what that means on stage, she basically opened up with the question, just because something is non-organic, something is manufactured, doesn't mean it's bad. So then she talked about the synthetic
artificial
flavoring. So did she? She talked about creating the tastes of strawberries, 20 different flavor elements that mix together to make what you taste as a strawberry.
It's literally the molecules that she spoke about, and she separated those molecules into 21 things on a plate of sorts, and then you could mix them together and start adding those flavors.
She turned it into a shape as opposed to just the drawing, just the symbol. She turned it into something three-dimensional.
So just to put the context, a molecule it's usually like a hexagon of sorts with little lines coming out of it, and she represented it in 3D form, and it's like kind of bubbly, kind of wormy, kind of gummy bear kind of way.
It's unsettlingly organic in its own shape.
Me visualizing a molecule, I always see there's a scientific drawing that you used to see in your textbooks, like those little visualizations of things.
And she added color.
Yes, and to denote if something was sweet, it'd be red. If something was veggie, it'd be green.
Which I find strange, because I think if you are the one grating this artificial flavoring onto your food, the color will affect the way that you taste it. You will have a predisposition to think
my theory, because when you buy a red sweet and they say strawberry, you go, it's strawberry. No, it doesn't taste anything like it. But your brain goes, the color with the suggestion of the packaging and everything together works. And I think it would have been not as appetizing.
If it was yellow strawberry.
Yeah. Everything was yellow. Yeah. As an example, it wouldn't be as appetizing.
The story of the banana. So the banana that we eat now is something like the Royal Banana. It's got some name. That's the banana we eat now. But the old banana, I think from like the 60s, that strain was wiped out by like a virus worldwide.
Okay.
Right? But they copied the flavor of that specific banana. So you can get certain banana sweets and flavorings that doesn't, that we as kids know as banana, that doesn't taste like the actual banana that we've been eating.
Yeah, it comes
from the ancient, it comes from the old banana. That flavor that they reproduce is based on that.
That's
very interesting. Also cool, she was talking about as a designer how you can now make up your own flavors by mixing up.
Yeah, you don't I can immediately see the product applications of being able to have, this is the taste of, the chemical taste of cheese, and you could add it to anything. You can mix and match, create your own flavor.
That is what food engineering really
absolutely
is. But but the idea that you separate the H2345 molecule, and that doesn't taste like anything.
Is that a molecule, H2345?
No, I'm just freaking making up a molecule there. Just showing my intelligence, which is H21234.
Two hydrogen molecules and some numbers.
But someone Google that. It's the molecule for shit.
It is probably.
Shit brains.
This is the fart smell. But again, it takes a little bit of a leap of imagination to go like, it doesn't taste like strawberry. It's one of the elements of strawberry that just puts it together. It's not salty, it's not sweet, it's something else. What does a molecule taste like?
All that you spoke about, the thing that was sitting in the back of my mind was people that create perfumes.
Mm.
So there's a limited amount of things that you can smell, notes, certain notes, and perfume creators will blend certain one of those notes. So she's kind of doing something very similar, just with molecules.
So as you said, perfume, I was just started rereading the book Perfume.
Wow.
And it's such the idea of, because she spoke about the olfactory system and where it sits in the back of your throat and all those things, and it just added another dimension when and I suppose like water for chocolate does that thing, that idea of that food can elicit different things out of you, just like the book Perfume did, where it was
totally
like, what smells do. I don't know where I was going with that one, but there's so much indescribable things that happen when it talks about food and smell.
Absolutely.
I think the big connection there in overall is same with design. There's certain designs you have that elicit certain emotions out of you. Food can do the same thing, whether it connects with something that you've had when you were a child, right, which is very powerful, or something that you just like, or something you've never tried before in your life.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And again, in the world of design, if I was to put a designing dauber ad in front of you about like, well, we're going to talk design, and you get chairs and you do get architecture, all the rational things that cover design is good, right?
Right.
But this is unexpected.
Yeah.
Completely unexpected.
I always love it when they bring a chef in, when they bring some kind of, I mean, I think this is the first time I've ever seen a structural engineer as a speaker.
You're right. I hadn't seen.
And it's closely linked. I mean, it's not even, the chef is, you know, you always go, wow, designs with chef, that's interesting.
Mm.
But I'm amazed that we haven't seen an engineer before. Yeah. We've seen a few engineers, but mostly the product engineer.
Yeah, it's usually guys who do cars.
So, I mean, having a quick glance across day one speaker list here, I would say that I found 7 out of the 12 total to be quite illuminating and interesting. I think that there, in my experience in any design in Daba, there's the things you're interested in and the things that you're not. There's the presenters who are good presenters and those who are perhaps specialists in their fields but are not particularly good at communicating what it is they're doing. There's the people who are just giving you a portfolio viewing without any context as to, you know, what are the philosophies behind it that you can adopt. Overall, from Zay, from your perspective, did you think it was a worthwhile day? How much of it, any negatives you'd like to chat about?
Overall, I think it was great. I think it was great to hear any ideas, any idea that I hear, the way my mind works, I start thinking about anything or how it relates to something, or what it can, where it can go. What if this person is talking to me about molecules with food? Is she going to, if the next time I see her, next year, 2021, is she going to bring out a bottle that the tip of the bottle has a flavor, but it's water in it? And now you're drinking it, and now you get the flavor through. Maybe that's the next thing she talks about. So if it doesn't seem like it's a big talk, in my mind, I push it to a far. Except for the our structural engineer guy, where that was, my mind was blown.
Yeah, well, how much further can that go?
Yeah, it's exactly. Yeah, yeah.
It can go much further.
No, sure.
When they started off to talk about where conversations lead to big things, when the with the opening speech from the tourism board guy,
right?
So yeah. And then where he spoke about, he showed like, so the Zeitmarker was a conversation we had Thomas Heatherwick down here, and then 3 or 4 years later, the Zeitmarker was one of his pieces, and it was from conversations with people here.
Right.
The arch for the arch in St. George's, where that was also a initiative by Design Lab. So it's these small seeds that get laid here do grow into things. Like I've seen my own work influenced by a lot of the stuff that happens here. So because you somewhere along the line it does go into the back of your brain.
You're totally right.
And we're allowed to steal. A little bit, just not copy directly. You're right. It's such a rad
tribute.
Build on.
Remix.
The thing behind, I kind of lost my train of thought now, but the overall thing about Design Indaba is when you do go into any of these speakers, like you said, 7 out of the 12 speakers didn't. If it's in your field, because there's a couple of hundred, how many thousand people are here? So within that realm, different industries will find different people more interesting.
Absolutely.
People from different cultures will find different speakers more interesting than others. So from that, I've always kind of approached every speaker and given them a chance. You know, like, try and find that positive in what they're talking about.
And don't worry if it doesn't land with you.
It's landing with someone
and expect there to be a hit rate and a miss rate, and that's fine.
Totally. And not everybody should get along and should agree about who's better or not. Just the fact that these people are on stage means that they are contributing somehow to something somewhere.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think the kind of view that we have, I think the way we view these talks, just if it was 20 years ago, we would be in our early 20s and we would view it maybe differently. I think we're much more spongy with our brains. And I think now, it's not just 20 years extra that we might have on these young kids. It's not just the 20 years of just information. It's the way that we think and how we used to figure things out back in the day. I mean, in our early 20s, we sound like this three grumpy old men now. In our early 20s, without internet.
And me and Lucas, but
yeah, without real proper internet and taking photos, we had to do proper. We had the encyclopedias and child graph, and we had to read. And like, it's a different way of thinking.
Yeah,
so
us guys who are in their 20s. Use the
speaking
internet
for
now.
The 20-year-olds on my side.
Like, I think we might just come off cynical, but I mean, like, I've got in my eyes have viewed days and weeks and months worth of talks, of presentations and stuff online, and just information and stuff. So, and I've seen things people spoke about 20 years ago, and it's been 20 years and nothing's happened, or some that they changed their minds completely and have gone 180. So some of the talks we feel like it didn't blow our minds that much, which is,
I think that brings it back to the fact that a lot of the experience is just being here with all these other creative people at the Artscape in the event. Because when we, for example, the last talk that we were at, second last talk was Takra, a design company from, well, they're all over the world. They're in the UK, London, New York. But their speaker, his name actually isn't on the...
it's a company called Takram.
It's a Japanese-based company called Takram. And he was talking, they did a augmented reality app live on stage where they showed how the water level and the ocean level can rise based on not offsetting your carbon footprint, or flying instead of, or taking your private car instead of public transport. So, you know, if you extend that conversation, you might as well have the argument that we should all sit at home and just watch YouTube, because we're not then driving to a show and, you know, using all this fuel and basically destroying the planet. Why don't we all just attend in VR? But then you lose that personal human connection that I still think is what actually adds the value. If we all just went into simulcast and there were no breaks and no lunch and you just wait, you just sit, you put a helmet on and you wait for the break to finish and then you go back into the simulcast, then yes, why not just look at a TED Talk? Why not just go to a YouTube channel? No, the value does seem to be in seeing it live.
My view on it is, just my personality, is that I would lose a little bit of focus if I was on my own time. I think this is kind of more this kind of thing makes me more disciplined. Makes me have to sit through, have to watch it, and
you paid for it. It's valuable.
Yeah, it's valuable. It's a weird way of actually forcing yourself to get something out of it.
So there's a thing with TED and these talks. Every TED talk we've seen is 3 to 4 years, maybe even older. You don't see it live. The premium you pay to go and watch that live, I think I did the research years ago about how, like 4 or 5 years ago, how much a TED ticket cost. It's about 150K in rands, and it's by invite only. It's ridiculous. So, that's a networking experience. So the value here is me and you sitting and chatting. It's like we sat with Mandy, the head of Vega, just now. It's those relationships that do get built with the information that you get. So I think, and if like let's break down, a lot of these speakers do tend to be TED speakers, so you're getting them at a discount rate. I'm not the value. Absolutely. I'm not saying the information is less valuable. We in Africa, we get to see this on the tip end of the African continent. We get to see world-class speakers. Yeah. And again, it's current information that's valuable versus I think our debate was, now sit online and watch this or come here.
There's something that's kind of it's kind of cool that you can actually walk up to any one of these speakers and say, I was there on your talk.
Yeah,
I've got this idea, but I sat there and talked. I think if I was one of the speakers, it would mean a lot more to hear from someone that was sitting in the building and watching me talk versus someone that just saw it online.
Yeah, totally.
It's a weird thing, yeah.
I think they get emails and fans anyways from that point of view.
It would show dedication. It would show like you spend money and you put time and you sacrifice. I mean, this is during the week. This is not a weekend, you know. Mm. And I mean, we're all freelancers, so we put out the time. But if we were trying to get into an industry or something, we work in someone else, we had to take 3 days off from work to come.
I must say, if I can quickly, now we're talking organization, I like the simulcast.
I agree.
I opened my laptop and quickly, speaking of, I needed to supply some work.
I drew up a quote on my phone while I was in the talk.
You could do that in the auditorium, but it's distracting for the speakers. Totally. So in this case, you don't feel that. Look, there's, again, the hobnobs on the other side. Been in that auditorium, and it's really, really nice. It's a different
sense. The Woolworths people.
The Woolworths also put their people here.
Those people, the Woolworths bags.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, you're talking about the food.
The
bag of pretentious,
The bag of lunch that they get.
That's
got
the bag of jealousy, man. We all want
Zaid
that
and
stuff.
I went to go and get a free bag of food. Turns out, no, simulcast members go outside.
Nice try.
Root amongst the...
Yeah, but you got vouchers, dude. You got food vouchers.
We got vouchers, absolutely.
Yeah, so we had... But I wanted a burger anyway.
I think there'll always be a premium on certain things.
But you're right, the simulcast was cool.
I also enjoyed the fact that I don't like personally when the MCs try to rev everyone up and stand up and dance around and act like a bit of an idiot, get the energy up and all that. I'm quite happy to, I'm a clapper, and I found myself clapping at people who can't hear me, you know, in another room 400 meters away.
But that's because you're excited.
And people picked it up, people did actually applaud, even though we're in a simulcast. But I found the lack of pressure nice. You could go and leave. The only real thing is, are you disturbing anyone else? Yeah. So no one was being loud, no one was being disruptive. No. But as you say, checking email. I was changing the cover image of the Resource Cost Instagram page while we were watching one of the presentations that didn't really grip me. And I enjoyed the relaxed nature of the simulcast.
Yeah, I think for the simulcast, they should allow us to have coffee inside there.
Yeah, it's actually about you spilling, I think. Now we're moaning about nonsense.
Yeah, that's just grumpy old man.
I would say, just to wrap it up then, if you're, hopefully we get this episode out tonight or tomorrow, which will be Thursday, right? Design and Darba runs Wednesday to Friday. If you're in town, if you're in Cape Town, but you're not going, you don't have a ticket, then show up for the lunch break or show up for the tea break. Come and look at the expo. They've got books and quite some nice merch on sale. It's nice to just,
nice food,
grab
food
a good coffee, nice food trucks.
So check
meet
the
up
events.
With some people you know.
There's the night.
There's some events exactly. Yeah. The Nightscapes going on. So do come and get involved, even if it's just to bump into some lucky agency folk who have a paid for ride by their company.
Yeah, and message us if you want to chat.
Absolutely. We're going to post this on the forum. If you want to meet up and have a chat, let us know.
Don't be shy. Oh, you stopped.
No, I haven't stopped yet, but I will now. Thanks, guys, very much for joining us. It has been a 52-minute quick catch-up after day one, so we'll be back tomorrow. Any last thoughts?
No, that's it. Look, if you do come and you see us, you'll see John looks like a mini-me. And just make fun of him if you see him.
I look like a mini none of them.
Yeah.
I'm the brown guy. But yeah, it's been great being on the podcast, guys. Yeah, cool. It's exciting.
See you tomorrow morning at around 9-ish, maybe.